Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning is League of Women Voters against the City of Chicago, 1329-77. Mr. Morales-Doyle.
Good morning. Sean Morales-Doyle on behalf of the plaintiff's appellants. May it please the court, I'd like to begin by addressing count three of our complaint, which claims that the city has violated the one person, one vote rule. What we have in this case is a ward map with systematic deviations from one person, one vote throughout and up to an 8.7% maximum. And these deviations are not the result of any legitimate state criteria. The district court did not address Cox v. Larios, but there's no dispute that that is the lead case on the issues presented here. And under both Cox and Baldus, deviations like these cannot stand when they are the product not of legitimate criteria, but of arbitrariness and discrimination. We know that these ward boundaries are the result of arbitrariness and discrimination for a variety of reasons, which we've alleged in the complaint.
So what do you think your burden is? I assume that you are taking the position that below the 10% level, it's not that it's a safe harbor, but that there's something else, but certainly the 10% level has been significant in Supreme Court cases. So what, in your view, is your burden at the pleading stage?
Our burden at the pleading stage is to plead that there has been a taint of arbitrariness or discrimination, or that the map is otherwise unsupported by traditional redistricting criteria. And if we're able to show that, if we're able to show that this 10% leeway is not being used, or that we're able to plead that this 10% leeway is not being used for the sorts of legitimate reasons that the 10% rule was created for, then that protection is gone, and now the city has a map which violates one person, one vote. So in
terms of pleading, though, in the post-Twombly-Iqbal, or is it sometimes called Twitball world, how much detail? I mean, surely you need to do something more than just say, we think this is arbitrary.
Agreed, Judge. I believe the standard is that we have to make this allegation plausible by alleging sufficient facts to make it plausible. We have done that in this case.
And so review for me some of the facts that you think are enough to meet your pleading burden.
Certainly. First of all, there are the deviations themselves, and I understand that the deviations alone are not enough. But in this case, unlike, say, in Baldus, we're much closer to that 10% side of the margin than we are zero. Secondly, we have, and by the way, these are deviations throughout, not just in a couple places. Secondly, we have the statement, the only explanation offered by the city at any point in this case, was a statement by the city council floor leader, which was that all we could do, explaining this map with these deviations, said all we could do is strive to have the largest number of city council members available so that we would not have a referendum, and that's what we've achieved. And of course, Alderman O'Connor was referring to the state statute which requires a 41-person vote in order to avoid a referendum on the map. In our view, that statement alone shows that this was the result of arbitrary criteria.
There's no just politics?
Yes, because it's politics, because it doesn't provide a principled basis for drawing the map the way that it does.
But that's what they do, is politics.
Certainly. We recognize, and we would never deny, that politics are a part of redistricting, often, if not always. The problem that we have is that politics, while they may run throughout the redistricting process, are not a legitimate reason for straying from the one fundamental principle that is supposed to drive redistricting, which is one person, one vote.
So politics would be okay if the districts were more like the districts in Baldus with tiny deviations of population, but politics is not okay, in your view, if there are significantly different size districts.
Yes, politics is, in Baldus, we think the court made clear that this was a borderline de minimis violation, 0.67% deviation from one person, one vote. So there has to be more than just saying there were politics involved to surpass the burden that the plaintiffs have. But I will point out that Baldus decided after searching factual inquiry into what drove this map. The plaintiffs passed the motion to dismiss stage well before the final decision in Baldus. But yes, politics are not an okay for one person's an okay reason for one person's vote to be worth less than another person's vote, in our view. And neither is we needed to get the votes. We needed to get the votes simply doesn't provide a principled basis for determining where maps are going to be drawn. There's
That statement could be seen as just some careless statement on the floor of City Council if there were other evidence indicating that there's nothing wrong with this map.
Sure, but of course there is no other evidence because we are only at the pleading stage. We have made an allegation regarding that statement and made reasonable inferences about what that statement means, and at this stage, we're entitled to those reasonable inferences. The third reason why we believe we've alleged facts to make this claim plausible are that there are two independent aldermen here that were made to walk the plank and their constituencies dispersed. This was political retribution. If horse trading and needing to get the votes done isn't an appropriate reason, then certainly ousting members, exacting political retribution, cannot be an appropriate reason for straying from one person, one vote.
Now, the city argues that you're, in effect, trying to advance the interests of these aldermen as opposed to the interest of the voters.
The city does seem to argue that we have to show that the arbitrariness or discrimination was somehow aimed at the voters that are the plaintiffs in this case, and we disagree. There's nothing in the case law that suggests that. The city's argument is essentially, even if we have no legitimate purpose for diluting votes, and in fact, even if we did so arbitrarily or for a discriminatory purpose, there's no constitutional violation as long as we didn't aim that arbitrariness or discrimination at the people whose votes were diluted. And we just don't think that makes any sense. In Larios v. Cox, there's no determination that the plaintiffs are Republican voters or rural voters whose votes are being diluted because of their party affiliation or because of the fact that they live in the suburbs or in a rural area. The decision is their votes were diluted, and the dilution is the result of things that aren't legitimate. The dilution is the result of political decision-making. That eliminates the 10% protection, and once the 10% protection is done, the only question is whether or not people's constitutional rights were violated, and they were. The deviation from one person, one vote is the constitutional harm. We have that here. The city has some leeway if they are exercising that leeway for legitimate reasons. When they're not.
You think that the legitimate reasons would be these traditional redistricting criteria that the Supreme Court talks about in some of the cases?
That would certainly be a starting point, Your Honor. There may be a variety of legitimate reasons that the state could offer or the city could offer in this case for why they're deviating from one person, one vote, but they'd have to be principled reasons. They can't be arbitrary reasons.
You're thinking things like traditional communities of interest, contiguity.
Correct. And as we've shown in our complaint, as we've pleaded in our complaint, none of those criteria can explain this map. These aren't compact and contiguous wards. That's obvious just by looking at the maps themselves. These are not maps drawn for the purpose of complying with the Voting Rights Act. That's shown by the fact that there are alternative maps offered that the city rejects that don't deviate from one person, one vote, that in fact do a better job of accommodating minority voting rights. There's no way this map is driven by keeping communities of interest together or traditional communities in Chicago together, because those things are clearly ignored. We have communities that have been together for decades that are dispersed into five different wards. It can't be, say, incumbent protection, even if that is a legitimate reason for drawing a map the way it is.
Is there any evidence? I mean, these communities do shift and change over, as you say, decades. So was there any evidence that actually these neighborhoods had stayed consistent since the last?
No, there's no evidence at this point because we're at the pleading stage. We've pleaded that these maps do depart from the traditional communities of interest, and if the city, once we move past this motion to dismiss, would like to provide evidence that shows that these communities of interest no longer are communities of interest or that there were some other communities of interest that were driving this map, then we'd be open to that. But I find it hard to believe, for instance, that the second ward that's been drawn here, which looks like, you know, the leftover spaghetti on a dinner plate, is a community of interest. This is dispersed communities that are linked by a quarter of a block. It's just not the case that this map reflects communities of interest, and we've certainly done enough to plead that.
This court has approved districts like that in congressional districts.
Sure, when there's an equality of population. But we don't have that here. We have an 8.7% deviation. Of course, this court has approved congressional districts when those congressional districts respect the one fundamental principle that is supposed to drive redistricting, which is one person, one vote. But we don't have that here.
Of course, exactly what happened in Wisconsin, and actually mirror image in Illinois in the last redistricting. The computers produced districts that had consistent numbers of people, and what else lay behind them in the political process, but without some additional violation, you didn't have a Reynolds point.
Of course, and we recognize that if the population is equal, we have a different burden, but the population is not equal here. I'd like to move on to count one with the time that I have. In count one, the basic question that we've posed is, should voters select their representatives or the other way around? And we think the answer to that question is obvious.
Here's my problem with your count one. There's a memorandum from the Corporation Council that essentially says that aldermen can serve whom they wish in the city. And so if an alderman wants to intervene for a zoning matter for somebody outside his or her ward, that there's nothing that prevents the alderman from doing that. And
sure.
Furthermore, when a map is passed, people are going to be interested to know who are they going to be representing in the next election, so they might be addressing those people. And so even though I can kind of understand from the letters that you show where people are saying, let's act as if the new map were in place, new map isn't in place, and there are still 50 aldermen in the Chicago City Council. So I'm having trouble grasping the theory that you're using here.
Of course, plaintiffs don't object to aldermen serving all of the constituents of the city of Chicago, those in their ward and outside, and in fact, we expect them to. But in the city of Chicago, in particular, with the way that the government works in the city, we have a municipal code that gives actual policymaking authority to individual aldermen. Right? This municipal code.
Do they have like a fund that they have to use in their ward?
They do. In fact, they have it's called their menu expenditures, and each alderman is given, I think it's $1 million. I don't remember exactly, but they're given a fund that they're supposed to spend within their ward.
And your allegation is that they are using those monies outside the old ward, but in what would be in the new ward.
Yes, in fact, we've attached an exhibit to our complaint
right.
that shows that. But
and
that's
where in the vote? I mean, why is that a voting rights? I mean, I guess again, you know, what's the theory that captures
so
this?
The menu spending, I think, is actually a relatively minor point when compared with some of the other things that we have here. When voters in Chicago elect their aldermen, they understand the system of government that we have in Chicago, which is that aldermen are actually given advice and consent type duties in some circumstances on some decisions, and then actual policymaking authority. They are the ones that sign off on decisions in their own ward. The city council respects those both as a matter of
veto power, in other words.
Yes, and this is an informal power that people recognize, but it's actually formalized in the municipal code as well.
Right. What principle of federal law is being violated by that approach?
The right to vote, because I elect my alderman in a system that recognizes that power of
no
the alderman.
No one is being disenfranchised.
They
may be deprived of some services of their aldermen, but they're not being disenfranchised.
If the city council is telling me that my alderman that I elected no longer represents me and instead it is assigning a different alderman to represent me, I do not have a voice in the decision as to who represents me in city council, and that is a violation of my right to vote.
But that can happen in a number of ways. An alderman could die and a new person could be appointed to that position, or you know, we have the deferred representation situations when Senate districts are scattered, you know, are staggered. I'm not sure that you have a right, under all circumstances at least, to the particular person. Of course, then they're whoever in the ward didn't happen to vote for the winning candidate. They don't have their alderman either.
Sure. You do not have a right to elect the person who you want to win. That's obvious. If you are part of the losing constituency,
yeah,
then you
so
are.
Get rid of those people.
But you at least play a part in the election of the alderman when you get to cast your vote.
Or
but
resignation. Alderman could resign.
Certainly.
And a new person could come
and
in.
And whether or not there's a legitimate state interest or any state interest that justifies replacing an alderman in those circumstances and abridging the right to vote, even temporarily, is a question for another day. Whether or not there is in a situation like that in Baldus where there's staggered elections, we have the answer to. That is a state interest that the state is pursuing that we can't possibly question. It's a principle that's enshrined in the United States Constitution. Staggered elections are a good thing as far as we're concerned. And as a result of staggered elections, there is an inevitable temporary disenfranchisement. And the courts have accepted when it's inevitable, when you're pursuing this legitimate interest, when we weigh those two things against each other, we recognize this is presumptively constitutional. But this is a situation where the city has come forward and say, we don't have to give a reason. We don't have to give a reason for this temporary disenfranchisement, and the district court accepted that. And that conflicts with Burdick v. Takushi, it conflicts with the court's decision in Baldus, it conflicts with any way of looking at government decision-making. The courts always require some at least rational basis for why a constitutional right is being burdened. And in this case, we have people, hundreds of thousands of people in this city, 2 years before the next election, being told their aldermen don't represent them anymore and someone else is being assigned to represent them. And when that happens, the city has an obligation to at least come up with a rational reason for why they're doing what they're doing, if not more than that. That state interest that is non-existent here needs to be weighed against the abridgment. And I don't know what the state interest would be in these other scenarios that we're talking about, resignation, death, etc., but that's another case for another day. In this case, the question is, what's the state interest, and does it weigh appropriately against this abridgment of the constitutional right? And so long as the city's position is they don't have to offer an explanation, then the answer to that question is obvious. This abridgment is not being explained, and we should be allowed to proceed. I've gone into my rebuttal time, so unless the court has further questions, I'll sum up quickly.
Fine.
In both counts, the city's actions are causing substantial damage to the form of representative government that we have here. And these abridgments of the right to vote not only lack legitimate explanations, they lack any explanation other than ones which are arbitrary and discriminatory. And on these facts, the plaintiffs should be afforded an opportunity to present their case to the district court. We don't think there's any question about that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Solomon.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Plaintiffs pressed two claims against City Council's 2012 redistricting ordinance, neither of which is cognizable as an equal protection claim. First,
but they're not making an equal protection claim, of course, so maybe we should start with the one person, one vote claim that they are raising.
Well, that's an aspect of an equal, that is a type of equal protection
right.
claim,
but
to be sure.
It's sure. I mean, but the city's brief claim makes it seem like, you know, say the Latinos had vote dilution or something, and they're not asserting that any group in that sense is having, or at least that's, as I read it, not the key point. It's a vote dilution case, right?
It is it's absolutely a vote dilution
right.
claim.
Okay.
Yes. And in particular for count three, the vote dilution claim centers on the idea that the boundaries of two wards, the second and the 36th, were drawn to target two aldermen whom plaintiffs describe as independent.
I thought that they were making a broader claim. In fact, the 8.7% maximum deviation doesn't come from these two wards. There are deviations that you can crisscross around the map in a number of different ways. And one thing that worried me about the city's argument, I hope this isn't what you're arguing, was it's, as I understand the law, there is no 10% safe harbor. There are burdens
correct.
That shift, but just because 8.7 isn't greater than 10 isn't enough to take the city out of a legal question, right?
Correct,
you would
Your
agree
Honor.
With that?
Absolutely correct. And, okay. and in our brief, we quite explicitly make the point that we are not making a safe harbor argument.
Okay. Okay
safe
good.
Harbor, as I understand it, would be it's under 10%. You put a motion to dismiss on file that says
and
it's under 10%,
right.
and the motion to dismiss is granted.
Right.
That's not our argument. That's not the law.
Okay, because you would agree that cases like Gaffney or even White against Register, Roman, a number of cases from the Supreme Court say you need to look. The plaintiff has a larger burden below the 10% level. Perhaps
correct.
The burden of proof is on the plaintiff. So what I'm curious about is really the same question I asked Mr. Morales-Doyle. What is the plaintiff's pleading burden, in your view, at this stage?
Our view of the pleading burden differs in a couple of substantial respects from the plaintiff's. We absolutely agree that below 10%, it is the plaintiff's burden to allege the taint of arbitrariness or discrimination. We are in common on those two elements. We disagree that the plaintiffs can add to the population deviation and therefore overcome the presumption of constitutionality simply by pointing to a departure from traditional redistricting criteria. The cases Your Honor mentions, Gaffney, White against Register, and others, mention both arbitrariness and discrimination, but the Supreme Court has never recognized that a departure from traditional redistricting criteria is a basis to state a prima facie case. When the court talks about that concept, traditional redistricting criteria, it is to justify a departure on a deviation on population. In other words, it's a defense. It's not part of the prima facie case.
Well, it's a defense in some circumstances, for sure, because we have burden shifting. But it seems to me that when you're trying to show that an 8.7% deviation is arbitrary, you need to explain why it's not justified, and it seems to me that gets into compactness, municipal boundaries, communities of interest, all these other things that we talk about in redistricting cases. And you're alleging a negative at this point, right? You're the plaintiff, and it seems to be that they have alleged that.
Well, I have a couple of responses, Your Honor. And the first, of course, is that the ability to proceed in federal court against a state and local redistricting plan with a maximum population deviation under 10% is the exception. The court tells us very clearly, especially in Gaffney, but there are other statements as well. Federal court involvement in those kinds of cases really should not begin absent the taint of arbitrariness or discrimination.
Well, of course, in Gaffney, the court says, it's a 7.83 there, but they say that the Senate and House district lines are drawn with the intent to create a balanced map, basically. I'm paraphrasing, but that's how I understand Gaffney. And here you have, the alderman making the side comment, we just didn't want a referendum. It's very hard to find in this record any legitimate reason that the city had for this map.
Well, and that's because reasons are not required at this stage.
Yes, under but 10 you have to be able to plead them. You can't have a pleading burden that turns into the equivalent of a safe harbor. That much we know.
We do agree with that, Your Honor. We absolutely do. So my point is simply that there are two ways when the population deviation is under 10%. There are two ways and only two ways that the Supreme Court has ever recognized. In fact, no case has ever allowed the plaintiff to go beyond the motion to dismiss by alleging a departure from traditional redistricting criteria. That language comes only from the Baldus decision. And quite frankly, Baldus does not, of six or so cases that Baldus cites, none of them puts that on the list. It's arbitrary and discrimination. And in fact, Baldus,
how do you prove arbitrary and discrimination?
Correct. Well, and we don't insist on proof. I'm sorry to talk over your
argument. No,
we're not asking for proof at this stage, of course. It's just allegations. But my point is simply that this standard is difficult for a reason, and that's because under 10%. And when we talk about equality in this range, equality means under 10%. That's what equal actually means in this context.
Well,
7.8, White against Register was 9.9%. Okay? And as Your Honor indicated, Gaffney was 7.8. So we're at 8.7, not even in the two wards that the plaintiffs complain most heavily about, and 74% of the wards are under 4%.
So what about Larios?
Larios is
affirmed
not
affirmed by the Supreme Court.
It is affirmed. We don't know the rationale, of course.
Not.
It could have been a variety of things. But the district court in Larios is a very, very different case from this case. But I want to step back for just a minute because we want to look at what was alleged in this case. There's exactly one thing alleged as arbitrary, and that is that Alderman O'Connor indicated that he wanted to avoid a referendum. And with respect, that statement actually says one thing. He wanted to avoid a referendum.
There are allegations, though, that the maps have very, that the lines are anything but compact and contiguous and that communities are broken. There are a lot of allegations in the complaint.
There are some allegations in the complaint, to be sure, and the briefs focus on primarily for arbitrariness, the briefs focus on Alderman O'Connor's statement.
Well,
now,
but
that
no,
statement,
I think you're picking it apart too much. Certainly they have his statement there, no question. But in the light of a record that shows no other particularly obvious reason why this map would have been drawn the way it was. I mean, I think the allegation is this is what arbitrary districts look like, and if they were equal number of voters, you probably can't do anything about it because, as Judge Kaney points out, this is all about politics. But when they aren't equal numbers of voters, we begin to have a problem.
Well, again, there is no case that relies on lines to state a prima facie case. No case.
Can you go back to Larios then for me?
Yes. Larios is a case where there was a 9.9%. It was by design. It was absolutely systematic. It was not arbitrary. Larios is a case involving discrimination. It is absolutely not arbitrary. It was very systematic. It was intentional. The lines were drawn where the lines were drawn because the map makers thought they could get away with 9.98%, 10%, if you round it up. So more important, the complaint there actually included the kind of allegations that are missing, crucially missing from this case. The wards, the districts there that were overpopulated for exactly the reason that was the problem in that case. The Democratic wards were underpopulated. The Republican wards were overpopulated. Rural, urban, suburban, it was the same exact thing. There is no allegation in this case why any ward was overpopulated. Whatever else Alderman O'Connor's statement may say, it certainly doesn't say. He says we wanted a consensus. You know, consensus is good in legislation. I mean, redistricting is primarily a legislative purpose. And when legislators comply with their legislative obligation, that's not arbitrary.
No, well, I'm not sure. Because I think if our starting point is one person, one vote, then, and we have to take into account the fact that the Supreme Court has consistently said that there is simply no way to get your hands around partisan gerrymandering or the kind of thing that might have been going on in Larios. But I take as a given that that's not a claim that somebody can state. You know, we have seen cases where it's quite obvious that's what's going on. So even if that's not what the city was doing, I don't think that helps me one way or the other in this situation. What I see is districts drawn with wide disparities for no particular good reason.
Well, our point, Your Honor, is that we're really not at the reason stage. It's improper to ask that. We don't have a burden to justify anything until the plaintiffs state a prima facie case.
Well,
and
they
have
pleaded a prima facie case.
To
you
state.
Understand, of course, we're
to,
not at summary
to
judgment.
To be sure, to simply state, to allege a prima facie case.
And they say, here's this map, here 8.7% maximum deviations, no apparent reason at all, certainly not justifiable by any of the traditional criteria that the Supreme Court has said would justify a map. And let's even forget about Alderman O'Connor's statement. I'm not terribly impressed with that one way or the other. But it seems like for pleading, I don't know what else somebody could do.
Well, it has to be tied to the voters and the voters' residence in overpopulated wards. That's exactly the allegation that was in Larios and isn't here.
Well, the voters in the overpopulated districts have diluted votes.
But there is no allegation why the wards that are overpopulated were selected to be overpopulated.
But why would it help? I don't understand why it would help if counterfactually, if we had an allegation here that the overpopulated districts tended to be in areas of the city of Chicago that vote Republican, if there are any areas of the city of Chicago that vote Republican. Why is that a better case, since we can't do anything about partisan gerrymandering anyway?
Well, I agree with you. I mean, the plurality, the court's latest word, to the extent that we can discern it, is that political gerrymandering claims will not 60.
I don't see. You'd be here telling me that that's not
so,
a good reason.
And that does bear on one aspect of our argument. You know, by the time you try to figure out who the independent aldermen are, if this case goes to that point, you know, they vote with the administration 53 or 62% of the time.
See, I'm not sure that that part of the plaintiff... The plaintiff has this other argument, maybe we should get to in a minute, about the two wards in question, Ward 2 and whichever the other one was, 36. All right, I see that as a different aspect of this case, one in which, you know, you've said, you know, as I understand your argument, at the minimum they haven't nailed down exactly how that violates any stated law, because in fact the nature of an alderman could change anyway. Now maybe, I mean, I kept thinking of all these hypotheticals. I kept thinking, well, suppose I went and voted for my congressman, and all of a sudden the state said, oh, actually that's not going to be your congressional district, and you're going to be represented by somebody from Carbondale. You know, I'd probably be very startled at that and feel that my right to choose the winner had been impinged on somehow. That's what they're saying.
Well, I think that's a different claim. That's their count one claim.
Yeah, and I don't see how the independent aldermen really fit too much into this first.
Well, we certainly agree with
three.
That. Well, what is missing here are allegations about the voters. That voters were identified for a particular reason having something to do with the voters.
Why does that have to be there in a one-person, one-vote situation?
Because
suppose a state sits down, or a city, you know, it doesn't really matter. Suppose the city of Chicago sits down and it just decides to have a whole bunch of districts that are where the disparity is, in fact, 10% or 15%. On your theory, that doesn't make any difference, as long as they do it for no particularly bad reason.
Well, there is no allegation here that we tried to go as close to the line as we could, that we didn't care if it was under 8.7%.
But wouldn't you agree that your theory says that even a 15% deviation is no big deal, as long as there isn't some underlying political or other animus?
No, Your Honor. The burden shifts at 10%.
No, I know that.
10%.
The ultimate legality, though, would still have to be tested.
It would, Your Honor. But the reason that the allegations about the voters matter, and they are absent here, and they were present in Larios, the reason that matters is because those are the people who are disadvantaged. Those are the people who bring the vote dilution claim. There's no allegation that anything about the voters of the city of Chicago caused the city council to put them into overpopulated wards and voters with the opposite and favored characteristic were put in underpopulated
wards. One of the problems in Chicago, it seems to me, and Chief Judge Wood alluded to it, the fact that you're Republican or Democrat doesn't seem to make much difference because there aren't very many Republicans, and even if there are, they don't vote like Republicans at someplace else. You have shifting allegiances in the city of Chicago. They're constantly shifting depending on the issue. And it seems to me that's more of a problem for the plaintiff in this case to pin down, because on one issue, saying having horse-drawn carriages in that particular ward versus not having horse-drawn carriages. I don't know how that breaks down on allegiances and groups, but I can't see that people on the south side may have real strong feelings, but they may. It's just a shifting. That's. And my question is, do we have other cases in which there are the partisan politics, the Republican Democratic politics, don't play much of a role in it?
There are cases where district lines were drawn for reasons other than politics. You know, I mean, the most common, of course, is race. There's no such allegation in this case. And, of course, the Black and Latino caucuses supported this map. It had the support of 41 aldermen. So it was a broad-based map. It had consensus. It's the way redistricting ought to be done. in order to state an equal protection claim, vote dilution, denial of one person, one vote, whichever phrasing is used, it has to be an overpopulation that is tied to something about the voters, and that's because they are the people whose claim it is. It's not the claim of the alderman.
It's certainly not the claim of the alderman. But the interesting legal question you're posing is whether, when you say it's got to be something about the voters, whether under the law, it has to be more than the voter simply saying, for no legitimate recognized reason, my vote is worth less than somebody else's vote. Is that enough? That's the issue.
We think it isn't, Your Honor, and that's because under 10%, the court really kind of doesn't want it litigated at all. It's not a safe harbor. We're not arguing that it is. But there is a burden on the plaintiff to come forward with allegations of arbitrariness or discrimination. Shapes won't do it. Every map has shapes. Lines have to be drawn somewhere. The government draws lines every single day of the week. You know, the drinking age could be 20. The speed limit on Lakeshore Drive could be 50. Those are lines that are drawn.
It isn't.
But those are lines that are drawn, and a little more one way or the other would be just as rational as where they are drawn. And this is a map with literal lines. And as long as they are rational, it means they are not arbitrary, they are not discriminatory. And so to be arbitrary or and no case relies on arbitrary. No case even defines arbitrary, and neither do the plaintiffs. They seem to think it means anything that isn't explained. But if that were the test, then there wouldn't be a 10% threshold anymore. And we know that there is. Not a safe harbor, but simply the place at which the plaintiff's
burden increases.
So just very, very briefly on the early implementation, as we've argued in our brief, there is no Monell claim on this in any event, no policy, and the claim would fail on the merits.
What about
regardless.
All those letters from the alderman? It seems that there is some evidence of a de facto policy.
Well, a de facto policy is not a policy.
Oh, yes, it is. A de facto policy under Monell certainly can be a policy.
To be a widespread custom and practice, it would have to be recognized by the policymaker. The complaint does not even allege who the policymaker for the city of Chicago is in this context. And without that kind of an allegation, we don't think it can be a custom or practice. But we would ask that the judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Anything further, Mr. Morales-Doyle?
Briefly, Your Honors. First of all, I'd like to basically respond by saying I think that under this standard the city is attempting to set forth just now in their argument, I question what the purpose of this term arbitrary is in all of this court language. The opposing counsel said that we've given no reason why some words are overpopulated and others are not, and I think that's the point. There is no reason why some are overpopulated and others are not, and if there is a reason, it's not a good one. It's the types of political reasons that were not good ones in Larios v. Cox. But the word arbitrary to us does have meaning. It's a meaning that courts use regularly. Courts are very frequently questioning whether actions are arbitrary or not. And the question is whether or not there's a principle that guides the way this map is being drawn. There's no principle here. We've eliminated all the principles that might be legitimate, and we pointed out
some. Well, that's how you've approached it, and I think the city is contesting whether that's appropriate. You've sort of set up the reasons that the Supreme Court has identified as legitimate reasons, these traditional redistricting criteria, and you've tried to plead, as I understand it, that one doesn't work, that one doesn't work, that one doesn't work. We've gone through and tried to show that. And so, as I said, I think the legal issue here boils down to whether combining a showing of the kind of disparity that you have with a showing that at least these traditionally recognized legitimate reasons don't work is enough. And if not, what more?
Well, we would take the position that we have not just alleged a series of negatives, although we have alleged those negatives. We've also alleged some positives, one of which is the statement by the floor leader, and another of which is the discrimination that was leveled at a couple of aldermen and their constituencies whose core powers were dispersed.
But I'm right, am I not, that those two districts aren't the 8.7 deviation. That's just the biggest one this
Certainly.
Year.
Certainly. What I don't know is where the city is getting the idea that the arbitrary action has to be targeted at the people who are harmed. Collateral damage is still constitutional damage. If my vote is impacted by the city acting arbitrarily, just because the city didn't have it out for me doesn't mean that my vote wasn't diluted. There's no case that suggests that if the city can dilute my vote for no good reason, just because it feels like it, and as long as it wasn't targeting it at me, then the vote dilution is okay. I don't know where that idea comes from, but it certainly doesn't mesh with something that says that arbitrariness is enough to throw this map into question. And the cases that give rise to this 10% threshold make that clear, right? This idea of unsupported by traditional redistricting criteria and arbitrary does come from those cases. That exact language used in Baldus doesn't come from those cases. But in Reynolds, the court says there are reasons why we might allow permissible deviations and it could still be constitutional. But there are specific reasons. And as long as you're using those reasons, then that's okay. Roman v. Sincox says that you can have those minor deviations only so far as they're required by those reasons. And so it does come from those cases. And then finally, I'd like to point out on the issue just raised on count one, the idea that we haven't pleaded a Monell claim here, and didn't address it in my opening argument, but I think when you have the heads of all of these important city council committees that do have policymaking authority themselves in their ability to keep things from going to the floor, in their ability to make suggestions to the city council as a whole, and also because individual aldermen have that policymaking authority in the code, the heads of those committees are sending letters saying, we will implement our practice of implementing this map early. We are going to continue our practice of deferring to aldermen. I don't know how that's not a Monell claim. I've run out of
All
time,
right.
so thank
run
you.
Run out of time, so thank you very much. Thanks to the city as well. And we will take the case under advisement.